We're talking about coal piles that have sat on the banks of the Fox River for decades now. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The Assembly last week voted in favor of allocating a little over $1 million to Green Bay to address the coal pile issue on its downtown riverfront. And if you live in Green Bay, have you noticed the coal piles along the Fox River? Do you live near coal piles anywhere else in our state? How has that impacted your life? We're at 800-642-1234. Brian Johnson is the alder person for District 9 on the Green Bay City Council. His district is where these coal piles are located. Alder person Brian Johnson, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, start out with giving us a visual of these coal piles. How much coal are we talking about here?
Oh, my gosh. I couldn't even put a number to it. I mean, just piles and piles. The site itself currently is about 40 acres worth of coal, right along the riverfront in our near downtown area.
Okay, so how big are these piles? Are they covered? Are they exposed?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, they do cover them. I think the covers are removed, obviously, as they need to move those piles around. It's one of the ways that they try to mitigate some of the damage that's occurred from the coal dust. But it's near impossible to keep these things covered all of the time. I mean, at the end of the day, it is a very industrial use, and it's one of those things that the history of the city of Green Bay grew up with industrial users along the riverfront. And now that, you know, you fast forward hundreds of years later and times have changed, and it's time for us to sort of modify the use of that valuable land.
Do these coal piles ebb and flow at all? Do they grow, contract, or do they just stay the same?
Sure. I mean, they as shipments come in, obviously they're going to grow. And what they do is it gets put onto train cars and it's shipped off to its final destination. So the city of Green Bay is a port city. And that means, you know, that we're going to take in shipments of large supplies like coal, among many other things, and gets stored. It's basically a staging area for the coal that was previously owned by the Koch brothers and Georgia Pacific, when Georgia Pacific, which is right down the river, would burn coal. When they terminated the use of coal in their facility, they sold the Sea Rice Coal Terminal to the Crow Brothers out of Pennsylvania. But coal still has a very viable use in our economy. Contrary to popular belief, coal usage was up nationally by 1% last year. And so it is one of those things that we do expect it to be one of those things that is very much needed in our area for many years to come.
So how have these coal piles impacted your district 9 in particular?
Well, I mean, certainly the easy target is just aesthetics. I mean, when you think about the type of neighborhood or area that you want to live in, to have very close to the heart of your downtown full of coal piles is not something you want. But more importantly, it does present what we believe is a safety hazard when you have coal dust particles that are floating all around you. A lot of the residents in the area have to, you know, kind of power wash their homes at least once a year to get rid of that coal residue that's applying to their siding, their windows. And it also floats across the river. And so if it's floating across the river, it's landing in the river. It's just one of those things that with this opportunity here, we think it's a real, it presents itself, I guess, this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to clean that up and move it.
We're talking about the future of coal piles on the Green Bay downtown riverfront. Brian Johnson is the alder person for District 9 on the Green Bay City Council. You can join in. Are these coal piles, do you live near coal piles or an industrial site perhaps somewhere in Wisconsin? How has that impacted your life? Has it decreased your home's property value? Are there medical implications? Have you accepted it as part of the character and landscape of your region? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Brian, the State Assembly last week approved funding to start the process of relocating these coal piles. And if the Senate approves this funding, the governor would sign it. Perhaps, how would you use this money? What are we talking about here?
Yeah, so it's a very complex layered issue, and the coal piles are really just one piece of an overall broader plan. What we're really looking to do is fund what's called a preliminary concept plan for the Pulliam plant. The Pulliam plant is owned by We Energies. It's being decommissioned next year, which is what's really creating this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. The Pulliam plant is located at the mouth of the river, so upstream about a mile and a half. But what it does is it creates the perfect staging area for the relocation of the existing coal piles down in the heart of my district. So what you have at the mouth of the river with the decommissioning of the plant is 220 acres of port access. And what we're looking to do is to acquire that property from Wisconsin Public Service, who has indicated an interest in having that conversation. And the preliminary site plan is really intended to do a number of things. In addition to the $1.2 million that the state is using to fund this through their Harbor Assistance Fund, which, by the way, is appropriated money. That's what its intended use is for, is to support port cities. The city will also step up and at least match that funding to be able to provide the plan that does a variety of things that would be required for the redevelopment of that site.
And so this funding that is through a grant program, Green Bay had initially wanted $1.5 million for this initial funding. This is looking at $1.2 million. Would that affect your plans in any way?
Yeah, the Joint Finance Committee did reduce it because that's the amount that was available in the segregated fund. And I think with $1.2 million, we're still going to be able to achieve what we want to achieve. I mean, when we said $1.5, you know, usually you're estimating what you think it's going to cost to do these things based on previous experience. And so if this bill actually passes the Senate and the governor signs it, we would immediately go through a request for proposal process, get a more tangible number of what it's going to cost. And then the city, of course, will have to mobilize some resources on our end to make sure that we can provide that match for the post-study work.
Let's bring in a call now. Jack is joining us from Caledonia. Hi, Jack.
Good morning. Question, if somebody else owns the pile, why is this government paying to have it relocated? And if it's an issue in this area, it'll be an issue wherever they move it.
Jack, thanks so much for that question. Brian, what is the deal with the private company's interests here, and shouldn't they be moving it?
Yeah, it's a terrific question, Jack. You've got a couple in there, actually. And so a couple responses to that. One is the private company is at the table right now willing to have a dialogue about relocation. As I mentioned, there is a new owner of that site, which is what is another contributing factor to the stars aligning on this. Now, they want to make some investments in that site. What we would like to do is have them make those investments in a more industrial area. Question comes up oftentimes, who's going to pay for that relocation? We don't know yet. That's part of what this preliminary concept plan is intended to do. And so we want to be able to unlock the potential of $100 million of new development on that existing site. We believe that with the size of that site and the pent-up demand that we have for not only housing but riverfront development, that we can achieve that. That's taxable base that helps fund all the things that city governments need to fund, including road infrastructure, police, fire. So why relocate it to another area? Simply because we're taking it out of a residential area, a downtown residential area, and we're moving it out into an industrial area where coal piles already exist. So the net gain, the net gain for us is to go from two sites along our riverfront to one site that is going to host this industrial product. But the real kicker here for all of us in terms of why the government's getting involved is that the relocation of the coal piles is really just the cherry on top of a bigger project. We're really looking to do is port expansion.
And we're going to pause right there on port expansion and the prospects of that as we talk with Alderperson Brian Johnson of the Green Bay City Council. You can join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about coal piles on the Green Bay Riverfront and efforts to move them. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The city is asking the state for funding through the State Harbor Assistance Grant Program, and the Assembly voted in favor last week. Have you noticed the coal piles by the Fox River in Green Bay? Have you wanted them to be moved, or did you not realize that moving them was an option? Be part of the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Green Bay City Council Alderperson Brian Johnson stays with us. Brian, we paused there on the issue of redevelopment, but first let's spend a little bit more time at this Pulliam industrial site. What would the Pulliam site be able to do if you were adding and moving these coal piles there?
Yeah, and that's really what's at the heart of this issue and what the primary motivator is. And so it's the Pulliam plant is being set to be decommissioned next year. And that's what's really making this discussion possible. And you're talking about 220 acres on the mouth of the river on an industrial site that has this opportunity to be developed. And so the $1.2 million is really directed at the Pulliam site and the redevelopment of that to allow port expansion. It is a harbor assistance fund after all. It's really at the local level that we're talking about the relocation of the coal piles onto that site. And the preliminary concept plan is really designed to tell us, you know, what we need to do from a stormwater management perspective, what type of infrastructure will be required, site fill analysis, geotechnical services, environmental remediation. Those are all things that are required whether the coal piles get relocated or not if we want to redevelop the Pulliam site for additional port expansion.
And you'd be looking at more of like this intermodal shipping container facility?
Yep, there's a few things that are on the table. And what we don't know yet is if the city would potentially take the lead on the redevelopment of that site or if the Brown County Port Authority would. Because if the Port Authority takes the lead, they may be interested in an entire site for the creation of an intermodal shipping container facility, which would allow the city or Northeast Wisconsin to take shipment of raw material and be able to store it in shipping containers on site and have it trucked out of there or trained out of there. It would essentially become a terminal.
All right, so moving back to where the coal piles are now, what if those piles move? What would you do with that land on the Fox River?
Yeah, so just a quick point of clarity. We wouldn't physically move the piles. What we do is we spend that down, and then new shipments would be taken at the new site. So
uh-huh.
You could be looking, you know, at a multi-year process here. It's not something that will happen overnight. But that land, it's riverfront, it's prime real estate, again, near downtown. Brown County is currently undersized by about 1,700 living units, which means that we need more apartments, we need more housing. I think that's the most immediate and obvious use, as well as additional commercial expansion on that site.
So at the Port of Green Bay, where the coal piles are now, what have you seen in terms of traffic or living conditions? You mentioned coal dust. What is it like to live near an industrial area in this area of Green Bay?
Well, I certainly think the residents would prefer not to. I mean, it's... I think when, as a community, as a government, I mean, we're kind of entrusted, right, for the health of the public. And when we recognize opportunities to correct certain scenarios, I think it's incumbent upon us to take those opportunities. So the relocation to this industrial site, what's nice about it is it's not surrounded by residential neighborhoods. It's got a buffer by way of the interstate and other industrial sites that maybe aren't involved in raw material moving. So it creates a nice buffer over there.
We're exploring the Green Bay Riverfront and the prospect of coal piles that have been there for decades. Brian Johnson is the alderperson for District 9 and the Green Bay City Council. These coal piles are in his district. Do you live in Green Bay? Have you noticed the coal piles by the Fox River? Have you wanted them moved, or did you not realize that reducing them down would be an option? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Brian, how have other members of the Green Bay City Council responded to this plan?
Well, I think we had unanimous support. We passed a joint resolution both by the Redevelopment Authority as well as the City of Green Bay and the City Council. Endorsing the removal of the piles, but to actually match the funding in post-analysis work once the preliminary concept plan is done. So there's general support of it. I think where, you know, the rub is figuring out how much is it going to cost to do this. And that's what we, that's what the plan is designed to do. And then, of course, from there, it's figuring out how do you fund that once you know what it's going to cost. I suspect that the private sector is going to bear quite a bit of responsibility, obviously, if they want to develop land that allows them to have business expansion. Where the government assistance is going to come in is likely by way of grants for things like environmental remediation, but the port expansion as well. I mean, that is a government-managed operation, and so we would expect to see some mobile investment on that front.
It sounds like you have the ear of the private company who has these coal piles, the Sea Rice Coal Company. When you have them at the table, do you find that they are willing to go through with this plan? What are their needs?
Yeah, and that's a key question, right? Because just because we don't like them there doesn't mean they have to move. State and federal law prohibits us from dictating land use when you're meeting zoning and regulatory requirements. And so we have to come up with sort of a carrot or incentive for them to relocate. And the biggest thing for them is coming through the river, they have three bridge lifts. They can eliminate that. That's a cost savings. But they can get a more efficient use out of that 40 acres at the mouth of the river because we can share in certain services like stormwater management that right now they have to bear that on their own. And so we will be able to consolidate some of that. And they're not the only industrial user that has a desire to see some port expansion. There are other industrial users that I think would increase their footprint, increase or grow the number of jobs that they offer if they have that access that the Pulliam plant site currently provides.
How long do you anticipate this process could take?
Oh, years. I mean, for 50 years, the city of Green Bay has talked about the desire to do this. What's really making it happen is the decommissioning of the Pulliam plant site. So, I mean, we would first, of course, not only have to acquire that site, but then you have to create development agreements with all of the private companies in terms of their relocation efforts. And then, as I mentioned before, it's not an actual we move them. It's a spend down and taking new shipments down the river. So, I mean, you could be well in excess of 5 years before this would really start to transpire into something very, very tangible.
Yeah, so lots of moving pieces here. You live and breathe downtown Green Bay and its riverfront. Do you find that this is the biggest issue right now facing the riverfront?
Yeah, I mean, you know, kind of the analogy that I provided up to our state senate was, I mean, never in the history of ever has anyone gone to a downtown and said, wow, did you guys see those coal piles? They're amazing. I mean, it's bad for tourism. It's bad for the image of the city. While we appreciate, again, the industrial virtues that come with that and how it supports a local economy. I mean, 25% of the jobs in Northeast Wisconsin are manufacturing, and this is the type of activity that supports that. So we honor that. We just think that there's a better use for it and that we can get a higher use per acre, higher value proposition per acre on that current site.
How is the riverfront doing right now economically? I mean, you have a strong industrial base there. How is it doing there and elsewhere economically?
Yeah, the last 10 years, downtown revitalization of the city of Green Bay is something really to admire. It's, you've seen tens of millions of dollars investment in our riverfront. The city has made some substantial investments by way of infrastructure and amenities, including the city deck, and we're about to break ground on the shipyard, which is a 20-acre site on the riverfront. So the city's made its investments, and the private sector has followed, which is exactly what you want to see in that scenario.
Environmentally, how is that Fox River doing there on the riverfront with so much industrial usage?
Key question. I mean, one of the topics that we've finally been able to take up, I mean, Bay Beach was a beach that the city of Green Bay closed, I think it was in the 1920s or 30s, because of pollutants and environmental contamination. And we're having the conversation. We anticipate to be able to open that beach next year as the direct result of a $1.2 billion riverfront cleanup that is going to be completed this year that was completely paid for by the paper companies. But it basically took out the PCBs out of the riverfront. It is the single largest waterfront cleanup in the nation's history.
So you're seeing a new era for the Green Bay Riverfront.
Well, without a doubt. I mean, I think you know, we're starting to see people and the usage of the riverfront return to the people. And that's really important. I mean, historically, not only has it been consumed by industrial uses, but we've literally had our riverfront lined with things like parking ramps. And now we turned our back to the river for so long, and now we're starting to re-energize that focus on how do we connect people to the water.
Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Brian Johnson is the alder person for District 9 on the Green Bay City Council, and his district is where the coal piles are located. Coming up, what does it take to get people from different ideologies to talk with one another and really, really hear a perspective that is unlike their own? Do you think there is a civility deficit in our world today? We talk with the National Institute for Civil Discourse, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. We take a look at the state of civility in America right after this news update here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and we're talking about civility in politics. You might define civility as politeness or courtesy and respect. Civility also is about seeking common ground. And a poll from Georgetown University earlier this year found an overwhelming number of Americans feel frustrated by incivility in politics. 90% of respondents said they're concerned about the, quote, uncivil and rude behavior of politicians. So what questions do you have about holding civil conversations with people of differing opinions? Is it possible to have expansive national elections and have them stay civil, taking the high road many months? We're at 800-642-1234. Carolyn Lukensmeyer is Executive Director Emerita of the National Institute for Civil Discourse. It's an organization that works to reduce political dysfunction and incivility. Carolyn, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, Kate, thanks for having me.
So here we have the fourth Democratic presidential primary debate tonight, the eventual nominee, of course, facing President Trump in the general election. How do you view right now the level of civility between candidates at this stage of the campaign?
Well, actually, Kate, I think the Democratic candidates have, in fact, held a very good commitment to staying civil and very, very few personal attacks or very, very few ad hominem name-calling, etc. So to this point, the Democrats have been pretty respectful of each other.
So you're giving them a pretty good letter grade here, but let's listen to an exchange from a previous debate. And we're going to first hear former Vice President Joe Biden, followed by former Housing Secretary Julian Castro.
They do not have to buy in.
You just said that. You just said that 2 minutes ago. You just said 2 minutes ago that they would have to buy in. You said they would have to buy in.
Have to buy in. If she qualifies for Medicaid,
are you forgetting what you said 2 minutes ago?
Be in for it.
Are you forgetting already what you said just 2 minutes ago?
So, Carolyn, clearly the crowd swept away there, seeming to agree that Castro crossed a line. What did you hear in that interaction?
Well, it is one of the few examples where one candidate has gone after the other in a way that, as you said, the crowd even expressed their distaste for that kind of treatment of people who are running for president. And I think Castro himself clearly understood in terms of it didn't have the effect that he'd hoped it had and has backed off of that. I imagine that we'll see that again this evening.
And Castro defended himself by saying, hey, this is why we're here. We're supposed to be debating ideas for the voters so the electorate has the information they need to make an informed decision. But so break that down for us, because debate and incivility don't go hand in hand.
Well, it's interesting. If you really look at the way debate is taught in high schools, in some elementary schools and colleges, debate is taught to share a very intense analysis of each other's ideas and points of view. Debate was not set up to catch someone out on a personal note. So I think we have distorted what debate is supposed to be when we put it in a political arena, Kate.
Well, we think of debate being a negative thing, but you're saying the roots of debate are really about making specific policy points?
Absolutely, and demonstrating why the position that I'm holding is actually more appropriate for the problem we're trying to solve than the position you're holding.
When I think of, college debates and debates among young people, they seem to be very carefully coached, and they also are following very specific rules. What about the rules of debate? Should we hold those to a higher standard here as we try to understand different viewpoints?
You know, traditionally in American politics, it was the League of Women Voters that sponsored the presidential events. And they actually did have a set of standards, a set of norms, a set of rules about how the debate should be conducted. And as our politics took a turn to being more personal, more attacked, eventually the League stopped supporting the debates. Now they go through the Presidential Commission on Debates. And in each of the last two presidential cycles, 2016 and 2012, issues arose about the debates that have pushed the commission into taking another look at what their rules for the debates are.
So rules becoming more of something we should debate, perhaps, or at least talk about. We're talking with Carolyn Lukensmeyer. She directs the National Institute for Civil Discourse, and she works with Congress. She works with communities across the country to increase civility. You can join in. Do you think the media encourages incivil debates? Have you seen examples where civility is done well in the press? What questions do you have about holding civil conversations with people of differing opinions? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Carolyn, what recent examples can you point to where the principles of debate were used effectively and civilly in our very polarized world that we're living in?
Well, Kate, this may surprise you, but the example that I'm going to point out actually came from our young people. If your listeners will think about the horrific shooting in Parkland, Florida, at the Stoneman Douglas High School. Those students, after the fact, as they toured the country in very, very contentious political areas to talk about the issues of gun registration, of the issue of how difficult it should be for someone who has been a felon or who has a mental illness to get a gun. Those students, all of whom were trained in debate, held those meetings around the country, facing opponents many times much older than they were, always holding their equanimity and always sticking with the content of the argument, never the character of their opponent. I thought it was a stellar example of how debate could forward our politics on some of our most contentious issues.
So they were a prized example in your view of using their viewpoint and doing it well. Where are these students today? How has this debate landed when the students went this road and just put their points out there?
Well, there were more legislation passed. There was more legislation passed at the state level post that shooting and the activism led by those students than we have seen in several decades in the United States. So, in fact, the strategy they chose was very effective. They then have continued their work in which they've taken even more directly political in supporting candidates who hold positions on gun registration or on the size of an ammunition clip. So I think their track record is pretty impressive.
Well, getting back to the presidential the primary debates we're seeing and candidates criticizing the fact that moderators are using Republican talking points in their questions or trying to pit candidates against each other in some way. Do you find that the news media is adding to this problem here that you're seeing as we talk to each other about issues?
Well, take tonight's debate, the one coming up. There has been quite a press in the national media to suggest that the Democrats, in order to distinguish themselves on issue, had better move into attack mode. So I think there is, because of the tradition of politics in the United States and the role the media has played, I think the media is not doing it to intentionally create incivility, but they're not recognizing that they're holding that position in a changed overall social context and a changed type of politics. So I do think the media is playing a role. You know, many of the candidates have responded back that they are not interested in attacking their opponents. They're interested in clarifying their policy positions through, in fact, intellectual rigor, through the use of data, through the use of anecdotal data from actual Americans' lives in terms of how the policies, rather than turning around and attacking their opponent.
So outside of the campaign, we're seeing outside of the debates, we now have the House's impeachment inquiry against President Trump because of the Ukraine investigation and the investigation that against his political opponent, Joe Biden. As you look at that, are you hopeful there will be civility throughout that inquiry?
Well, I do think that that is what Americans want. The poll data that you read at the top of the hour has been consistently verified time and again that Americans really believe incivility is now a crisis. So I do think the press from the public on the committee chairs running the hearings is to continue to go for the facts, but to do so in a way that represents the civility and respect that really makes a democracy function.
President Trump and his supporters have called this impeachment inquiry a witch hunt and the Democratic Party's attempt to reverse the results of the 2016 election. How does intense partisanship negatively impact as you look at civility?
Well, there is no question, but what there's a direct cause and effect relationship between hyperpartisanship and the increase in incivility and disrespect in our politics. You know, George Washington, in his farewell address to Congress, really warned the country about the negative impact of partisanship. And he wasn't even framing it as hyperpartisanship, Kate. He was describing that when my commitment to my party becomes higher than my commitment to my country, by definition, we're losing the forces for what the American government was formed to do, which was to protect the interests of the common good and national security. So I think there's no question about what hyperpartisanship, the issue of impeachment itself. If you talk to any outside experts, people who understand the Constitution, there is a trail of facts here that demonstrate the president took an action in Ukraine outside of the framework of the Constitution.
And we have to pause right there with Carolyn Lukensmeyer here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. If you're just joining us, we're talking about civility here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Are you tired of the bitterness you hear, the entrenched sides of the political aisle? Are you looking for ways to talk about difficult issues in a respectful way? Polls find the majority of Americans perceive incivility to be a problem in our country, and they point to social media as a big culprit. So what do you do in your personal life to promote civility? What does it mean to you? How do you conduct yourself on social media? How do you read, digest, and react? Let's talk about it here at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Carolyn Lukensmeyer is our guide. She's Executive Director Emerita of the National Institute for Civil Discourse. Carolyn, you know, we've been discussing how the media is handling the debates and the civility and whether it's civil, but what about the press more generally? Could they be covering current events in a more civil manner?
Well, one of the interesting things is, again, many surveys done of the public is what they really want from the media is to also tell the stories of what people are doing to combat this incivility and disrespect. One of the wonderful things about working at the Institute is we have a chance to interact both with elected officials all over the country and state legislatures and the public. And when you actually are out around the country in communities, you find as many positive examples about the relationship between the media and the community, and even more important, about what people themselves are doing to combat this incivility. A couple of examples. Not too long ago, we were in Cleveland at a city club, and a young woman came up after the panel. Her name was Megan Anderson. She started with her colleagues, so some college friends, a whole effort on Friday nights in the Cleveland metropolitan area that they call Craft Beer and Conversation. And they go to a different craft bar around the city, bring together people of different points of view, and set up an opportunity for them to get to know each other as people. And she just did this on her own. The Council of Churches is doing work in many, many churches across the country to actually deal with parishioners who were part of a very good, solid community before the 2016 election that have stopped talking to each other. We get all kinds of requests at the Institute to help organizations to bring in, you know, Americans want to connect, Kate. It's not where we are, this antipathy and this moral judgment of each other because we're in a different party or voted for a different candidate. That is not typical of Americans or American politics. Historians say it hasn't happened to us since the Civil War and the post period of the Civil War. So Americans are anxious to get reconnected. They just need support to do that across these many divisions.
You had mentioned Cleveland there and the work of a younger generation, millennials there, bringing people together. You've also been in Milwaukee working with some millennials, I understand.
Well, at the Institute, we've understood that what we have to do is go to scale, Kate. How can we fight back against millions of people hearing all this negativity every day? So we've initiated with a partner, New Voice Strategies, a docuseries for television called Divided We Fall. And one of the groups that we've filmed is a group of very diverse millennials from the Chicago-Milwaukee area. So we brought together for a weekend 12 people, six of whom are very, very strong Trump supporters and six of whom are very, very strong Trump resistors. But we set up so they met each other as people first, Kate, so they understood who they are, what their values are, what they do in the world. And by the time the tough issues about politics got introduced, they had been connected enough as people that they were intrigued to listen to one another. And by the end of the weekend, they came out really saying, you know, I'm very surprised, but I really like these people. I'd like to stay in a relationship with them, even though they voted differently than I did. And the stories of how these young people changed their lives after this experience, a young organizer, Cesar from Milwaukee, is now the on-the-ground organizer for the entire Lutheran outreach process for the state of Wisconsin. Another young man named Ernie in Chicago ran for the city council. So this discovery that we can dialogue across our differences really promotes people taking the courage of what they'd like to be doing to make a difference as opposed to what they were doing previously.
We're talking with Carolyn Lukensmeyer, who leads national initiatives to teach people how to debate respectfully, how to listen to each other, especially when they disagree. Have you been following the Democratic presidential primary race? Does it seem civil to you? How does it compare to races of years past? Do you think we should build civility into our rules, our legislative rules in our state and in Congress? We're at 800-642-1234 for you to join in. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Carolyn, your organization is also working on the state legislature level across the country to encourage civility among government, among state government. And there's, I understand, potential to come to Wisconsin with this initiative. What is it doing?
We call the program Next Generation, And for 5 years, we've been doing workshops in state legislatures called Building Trust Through Civil Discourse. And we spend time in the legislature supported by leadership with the right appropriate percentage of Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Green, whatever the reality in that state is. We bring them together, and very much like what I just described we did with millennials around Milwaukee and Chicago, we create the opportunity for the legislators to get back in touch with what motivated me to become a public servant, what are the values I really want to bring to bear for my constituents. And the same process happens. They get reconnected as people. More bipartisan legislation is passed once they have had these conversations. My favorite example is in the state of Maine. When they convened the legislature this last January, the president of the Senate, Troy Jackson, and the Speaker of the House, Sarah Godin, actually got together and said, we need to do something that builds relationships between the Republicans and Democrats. So they did a simple decision, but quite radical in its effect. They changed the seating chart. So instead of the famous across the aisle, all Republicans on one side, all Democrats on the other side, they just put RD, RD, RD. And they also mix them by suburban, urban, and rural, which is one of the biggest political divides in the country. So what we see happening, Kate, in this, we've worked in 16 states, more than 1,000 legislators. More bipartisan legislation is passed, and more comedy, more civility and respect is introduced again in the state house.
Do state houses reach out to you and say, hey, we need help, or do you come to them? How do those relationships come to be?
Well, in the beginning, we reached out to be in partnership with the two national organizations that the vast majority of state legislators belong to, the National Council of State Legislators and the Council of State Governments. And we went to their annual conferences, Kate, and we presented a short version of the workshop that I just described. So members had an actual taste of it. They saw what would happen if we came to their states. Once we got started, then often there's communication between the leadership from one state to another state. So an early state we worked in, Idaho, which is a very red state, very often was called by majority leaders and presidents of senates in other states that are dominantly red in their representation. And they would ask the president and the speaker, what was the impact of this in Idaho? And that has led us to be invited into many other states that are dominantly red.
And so as we wrap up here, just a few seconds left, you know, we regularly hear how this is an incredibly polarized time. President Trump lives and breathes on Twitter. Where do you see hope for civility at this point?
Well, one thing that your listeners really should know about, because most of the negativity is coming out of Washington, but there are signs of hope even inside the House of Representatives in Washington. Nancy Pelosi started a select committee on the modernization of Congress, and they held a hearing on civility just 2 weeks ago. And in that hearing, Keith Allred, our new executive director, actually proposed 12 action steps that the committee could take that could increase the working relationships between Republicans and Democrats inside the House of Representatives.
And we have to leave it there. Carolyn, thank you for joining us.
Kate, it's my pleasure. I'm delighted to be part of your program.
Carolyn Lukensmeyer is Executive Director Emerita of the National Institute for Civil Discourse. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.